I know of no set of proposals which can offer the comfort of peace to the troubled tensions, the roiling angers of the Middle East. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger gained some reputation as a peacemaker for days and weeks of shuttle diplomacy between the capitals, Jerusalem, Amman, Damascus, and Cairo, when in fact he was not arranging peace at all, but simply establishing some very fragile and temporary accommodations which might give the countries the opportunity for more substantial negotiations. What happened at kilometer 102 and at Geneva and in those shuttle talks happened because Egypt needed to get the Israel Defense Force out of Egypt, because the Soviet Union was most eager for the reopening of the Suez Canal so that she can begin to supply directly her growing naval force in the Persian Gulf, because Syria had nothing to lose by being able to move her armor and armies forward in the Golan, because the United States was burdened with the oil problem, was eager to end the oil blockade, and because Israel could not withstand the pressures of the world and most immediately needed the resupply of arms to make up for her losses in the October War, a resupply which was promised to her as the carrot at the end of the stick by the American government. But at no time in those meetings or in any meetings subsequent have the Arab states indicated that they are willing to seriously begin the other half of the necessary negotiations. You recall that the United Nations Resolution 242 required several things, essentially a balance between Israeli withdrawal from the lands which were conquered during the 1967 war against the willingness by the Arab countries to devise a modus vivendi, to accept non-belligerency, the recognition of the existence of the State of Israel. For the last 30 years, this is something which the Arab governments have been unwilling to do. The Foreign Minister and Secretary of State and United Nations resolution and Israeli urging have been unable to break through this stone wall of intransigence. Now, there's been a great deal of wishful thinking and wishful reporting in the West, which would lead you to believe that there has been a remarkable breakthrough among the Arab leaders, a new willingness to live and to let live. But if Israel will only give up some territory, the Arab states are prepared to enter a state of non-belligerency and even to recognize the existence of the State of Israel. But officially, publicly, no Arab leader of consequence has said that. No Arab leader has indicated that he is willing to negotiate with Israel state to state. None has talked openly of negotiations and recognition once certain territorial arrangements are made. There's been a great deal of comment in the press about the fact that Mr. Sadat, our new favorite Arab, is a moderate, even though he began the October War, and that he is willing to enter into negotiations with Israel. In point of fact, all that Mr. Sadat has said is that Israel must withdraw from Arab lands, all Arab lands, and he has not indicated what he means by Arab lands. The Arabs still claim all of Palestine. And that there must be a complete recognition of the rights of the Palestinians, without any indication of what these rights entail. Some recompense for lands, repatriation, the claim to control of all of the territory, which is now Israel. You recall that Tuesday of this week, the United Nations voted 105-4 to invite the Palestine Liberation Organization, the umbrella group of terrorists who have been busy these last years at Nahariya and Kiryat Shmona, places and bombing in the airports of our world, to appear before the world body as an official representative of the Palestinian peoples when the Palestinian issue is debated before the General Assembly early in November of this year. And again, there has been some attempt in the press to describe Yasser Arafat, the head of the Palestine Liberation Organization, as something of a moderate. He is a moderate by comparison with men such as George Habash and Hawatme, the leaders of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the Al-Saqiya, men who will not even agree to live and let live with other Arab governments. They are convinced that there must be a radical Marxist or Maoist revolution, a true radical Arab world, radicalized Arab world, and they are not willing to deal, as Arafat is willing to deal, with Egypt, with Syria, with the other existing governments in the Middle East. But if you mean by moderation the willingness of a man to state certain territorial claims for the Palestinian people and then to live on some basis of amity with Israel, Arafat is no moderate. He has never indicated anything but his demand that all of Palestine is Arab and must be returned to the Arab peoples. 2 weeks ago, in his most recent interview for a French parochial newspaper called the Témoignage Chrétien, he was asked if he would negotiate in Geneva, because the Arabs have, the Palestine Liberation Organization has demanded representation in Geneva. And he said, we have no argument per se against the theory of dialogue, but we will not meet with Israelis as Israelis. And when on Tuesday night the representative of the Palestine Liberation Organization, who's been in New York officially as a member of the Libyan delegation to the United Nations, a man named Nabil Sha'at, gave an exultant press interview. After all, the world body had just recognized the Palestine Liberation Organization as a state, as a power, and given it legitimacy. He said three things. One, Palestinian people demand all of Palestine. Two, those who made Resolution 242 will simply have to undo Resolution 242. And thirdly, when pressed as to whether now that there's a new responsibility given to this group, whether they will become more responsible, give up some of their terrorism, he said, yes, we'll become more responsible, but we will continue to take any act against the squatters in Palestine, which we deem it advisable to take. Wishful thinking to the contrary. The Arab world is indicating again, as it has indicated since the United Nations debates of 1947, that it is unwilling to live and let live with the State of Israel, whatever be the boundaries agreed on with that state. Given this as background, I've tried to understand what Mr. Kissinger has been trying to do in the Middle East these last several weeks, where the drift of American policy seems to be taking us. And insofar as I can make any sense of this eminently calculating man, seems clear that this last visit to the Middle East had as much to do with the oil problem as it had to do with the Palestinian or Israeli or Arab problem. Mr. Kissinger spent as much time, a apparently more effort, meeting with Faisal in Saudi Arabia and Boumediene in Algeria than he did in his calls in Cairo, in Amman, in Damascus, and in Jerusalem. And the one hopeful and much trumpeted accomplishment of this visit was the release he authorized to be issued after his meeting with Faisal. But Faisal, though he would not act unilaterally, would do something or other unspecified to try to see to it that the price of oil was either slightly reduced or was certainly not increased. It seems that the message that Kissinger had brought to the Arabs of the Middle East was essentially this: I have been leaning on Israel, and now the United States expects the quid pro quo. We cannot tolerate and will not tolerate the fourfold or fivefold or sixfold increase in the price of oil. You must do something about lowering the price to a more reasonable level, which will not wreck the economies of the West. Whether he met with any success in this is problematic. Though it did not receive much publicity in the American press, 2 days after this release by the entourage of Mr. Kissinger in Saudi Arabia, it was quietly announced in Riyadh that the Saudi Arabian government had just increased the royalties demanded of the Aramco consortium of Western oil producers, which in effect increases the price of oil for all of us. Before he left for the Middle East, Kissinger defined his purpose in these terms: to give concreteness to the negotiating process. Now, insofar as I understand the double talk and the gobbledygook of diplomacy, this means simply that he's trying to get maps and to have down, put down very much on, very clearly on paper, the maximum demands of each of the states which are involved in this dispute. Mr. Kissinger is, whatever else he is or is not, is no dope. And he recognizes that at some point he is going to have to listen to Mr. Rabin if he wants Israel to withdraw, if not this time, a third time, a fourth. Rabin has indicated very clearly that from now on there must be a combination of elements in the negotiating process. It's not simply a question of how far Israel will withdraw. The question is also is what steps will the Arab states make towards recognizing a state of non-belligerency. And these steps might include the removal of the embargo on Israeli-bound shipping through the Suez Canal. They might include the opening of telephone lines and roads between Israel and Egypt, Israel and Lebanon, Israel and Jordan. They might mean the existence of certain trade between these countries. It might involve the end of the economic boycott by one or all of these countries against Israel. There are many ways to signal a willingness to enter a stage of non-belligerency, public and treaty-wise. But he recognizes also that, he must recognize now, that far from moderating their demands and becoming more agreeable to the second part of the UN resolution, which obviously needed for any lasting peace in the area, the Arab states have in fact escalated their demands. Mr. Assad in Damascus told Kissinger very bluntly that the United Nations force which now interposes between Syria and Egypt will have to be removed in December when its mandate runs out unless Israel immediately withdraws from all of the Golan. He made no comment about political arrangements. All he wants is territory. Assad, the Syrian government, has never shown the least interest in establishing modus vivendi with the Jewish state. With his own moderate friend, his good friend, whom he kisses so often, Mr. Sadat, Mr. Kissinger found that the Egyptians, too, had increased their demands. After all, they had just sent off a foreign minister to Moscow for new arms. The Saudi Arabian government had just promised them several billion dollars of economic aid. And he found that the map which was presented to him in Cairo required now as a second stage about two-thirds of all of the remaining Sinai, including the great oil fields there, And that Sadat spoke not at all of political arrangements and non-belligerency. All he said was that if this territory were promised to him now, he would go to Rabat, where the other Arab states, all the Arab states, will have a summit conference in 2 weeks, and he would push there for the continuation of this process of piecemeal negotiations. Nothing was said of political arrangements, certainly not publicly. Nothing was indicated that would give anyone the feeling that Egypt was prepared really in the long term to live and to let live. And whatever be the private understandings, if there in fact be any, Mr. Sadat went just before Mr. Kissinger came to Cairo to a graduating ceremony of some Egyptian military cadets. And he told them there very frankly, he said, in the next few years, we may not be able to solve entirely the Palestinian problem. But we will give you the political considerations, the political objective situation, which will allow you to solve it as we want to solve it, totally, within a decade or two. Now, whenever the West has run up against the obstinacy of the Arab world, our columnists and our politicians have a way of assuming that all can be made right if only Israel will be more forthcoming. During the late 1960s, you recall, the line ran as follows. The Arabs cannot possibly recognize Israel or deal with Israel in terms of non-belligerency because they have been beaten. They need the amour propre. They need a sense of self. And beyond that, if Israel will only make a major unilateral withdrawal, then the Arab states will be able to deal state to state with Israel. Well, no Arab statesman said, in fact, if there is a withdrawal, we will enter into political negotiations with Israel. And therefore, Israel could not withdraw. She could not give up a tactical military advantage for no advantage at all. Today, the argument runs that if the Arab states, since the Arab states are adamant, the solution to the problem lies in Israel giving over to the Palestine Liberation Organization, the West Bank and Gaza, as an independent Palestinian state. And having done so, miraculously, all the problems of the Middle East will disappear. How so? Well, there are the objective rights of the Palestinians to Palestine. They have their own nationalism. Their national needs must be met. And if we take a bunch of terrorists and we give them a state, they somehow will become statesmen. Forgetting that in history, most of the so-called statesmen have been among the world's worst pirates and bandits. Now, the problem with this whole line of reasoning is that though there are legitimate needs of the Palestinians, both economic and political, and in terms of their own nationalism, such a state would be unviable economically and politically, and can only increase rather than decrease the tensions in the area. In the first instance, no member of the Palestinian community, the Palestine Liberation Organization, has ever admitted the fact, stated the fact, that they will be satisfied with this little canton of the West Bank and of Gaza. In fact, they agree with singular unanimity that Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and Haifa are Arab and must be returned to the Arab world. But more than this, even if they could be induced or seduced to accept this small canton as a Palestinian state, they could not make it viable. They would have inevitably to become expansionist. There are today 400,000 Palestinians in Gaza. They are among the poorest people on the face of the earth. Egypt did not want Gaza to be declared Egyptian territory in 1947 because it could not afford the economic drain of 100,000 Arabs who lived in Gaza at the time. The 850,000 Palestinians who live in the West Bank make out fairly well because 100,000 of them travel over to Israel every day for employment.
If we look at the whole area, Transjordan and the West Bank and Gaza, that area has not been economically self-sufficient for 2,000 years. For as long as Jordan has, there has been a Jordan, since England proclaimed the state out of the desert in the middle of the 1920s, Jordan has lived on the dole, first of Great Britain and then of the United States. There are very few natural resources in the area. And if we exclude Transjordan and we look at the West Bank and at Gaza, the community lacks the basic tools for survival as a state. And if we assume that it is to be a Palestinian state, and that Lebanon will insist, as she must, that 250,000 Palestinians in the Lebanese camps return to the West Bank, and Syria insists, that Syria inevitably will, that the 150,000 Palestinians in the camps in Syria return to the West Bank and to Gaza, you'll have a human garbage heap which cannot survive. There's very little arable land that is not now being cultivated. There are no natural resources which are not now being exploited. And if we talk of the 900,000 Palestinians who are on the East Bank in Transjordan, and assume that some of these, the poorest of these, those who have been kept in camps there, will have to return, you have either a nightmare dream, a tragic human dimension, or an obvious cause for a political explosion of nightmare proportion. The idea of a Palestinian state on the West Bank is one of those incredible dreams that politicians like to put before the world when they don't know what else to do. There are 3 million Palestinians in the world today. The West Bank and Gaza cannot support the 900 to 1,000 to 1 million Palestinians who are now there. What will it, Arafat, suddenly made the master of this mini-state, be able to do? He must do one of two things, or perhaps both. He must work for the open subversion of Jordan, where there is more wealth, and 900,000 built-in Palestinian guerrillas, subversive, and he must work for the subversion of Israel, where there are the ports, and the industry, and the roads, and the economic infrastructure. He has no alternative, even if he wanted, which he doesn't. If you want a recipe for disaster in the Middle East, proclaim the West Bank and Gaza Palestinian state. Now, Israel is no friend of King Hussein. And when Israel says that any arrangement between among the Palestinians must somehow involve Jordan, they're not interested in increasing Jordan's power. It was the Arab Legion in 1947 which drove into the West Bank and bifurcated Jerusalem and caused the worst casualties of the war. Hussein in 1967 could not stay out of the war with Egypt and Syria, and Israel paid a terrible price for the recapture of Jerusalem. There's no love lost with Hussein. The Israelis are not saying to the West, we want the old Jordan back in place again. But they say Amman must be considered as the basic element in this puzzle of what to do with the Palestinians, because there's no other practical solution than one which at least assumes that whatever it comes into being in the West Bank, in Gaza, includes also the strength, such as they are, of the East Bank, of Hussein's community. I know of no plan which offers any real possibility in the short to medium range to establish peace in the Middle East. And when the politicians of the world and some of the academics of the world begin to envision such plans as the Palestinian mini-state, I know that deep down they have no plan either. How then can I have hope for Israel? And what kind of hope can I have? Obviously, one of the reasons for the for Arab intransigence is not only Arab obstinacy, but growing Arab power. Imagine 105 nations of the world voting to legitimize the terrorists of the Palestine Liberation Organization. And not simply the Third World, and not simply the Russian world, and not simply the Chinese world, but France, and Italy, and Norway, and Sweden, and Ireland, and Brazil, and Argentina, and Chile, and Peru, and Venezuela, and all of Black Africa. The oil weapon works. And the Arabs know it. Every day the wealthy, the greedy, the leaders of finance and industry of the world are getting into the Arab capital. The real sense of power. Oh yes, they hear the Western countries saying, when Israel gives up the West Bank and Gaza, we must see to the stability of Israel, its survival. But the Arab countries know exactly at what to discount those words. They know the West really doesn't want a Munich. They know that the conscience of the West would like to see Israel survive, but they also know that in October of 1973, every country in Europe, save Portugal, closed its ports, airfields. The United States government, when it began to resupply the Israel Defense Force. Unless that last little country be forgotten next time, the Saudi Arabian government has recently offered to Portugal several hundreds of millions of dollars to see to it that the Azores airfield will remain closed to the United States if it could ever attempt such an operation again. Europe talks politely and honestly about wanting to see Israel survive, but they've left the defense of Israel entirely to Israel and to the United States. They're not about to lift a finger. And the Arabs know that things are changing in the United States. Foreign aid is having a very difficult time passing through the United States Congress. Isolationism is growing as our economy becomes more and more in disarray. The Arabs know that the David Rockefellers and their kind are coming, getting in every day to their capital,
bringing new offers of money, investment, capital, purchase, land, industry, corporations, and that these men are men of power and influence, and they can be used to change the nature of a political reaction in the United States. They're not quite sure yet how the United States will come down. That's why they are not quite sure how far really they can take the oil weapon. But the Arabs have a sense of power. And when one feels one's power growing, there's no reason to change a policy in midstream. Is there then any hope? I think there is. Not a hope which is tied to a plan. Not hope tied to some short-term solution. Mr. Kissinger's comings and goings, as far as I can see, can only lead to further temporizations. He will not achieve peace. Certainly not in whatever term he will have as the servant of President Ford. But what gives us some hope for peace, or rather, what gives us some hope for the survival of Israel? Some weeks ago, you recall, the Syrians and the Egyptians began to rattle a new weapon, a long-range, ground-to-ground missile which had just been shipped in by the Soviet Union. And Assad particularly began to talk of his ability to reach any capital, any inhabited area of Israel with these weapons. They're powerful, and they're effective. We don't have to worry as whether or not the Arabs have the capability of handling these weapons. There are North Vietnamese and North Korean technicians in Damascus who are handling them now. Mr. Rabin made a very quiet, very specific response. He warned the Arab leaders that Israel would not be restrained from taking preemptive action. The kind of decision that Mrs. Meir made in October would not be made again. And he warned the Arab leaders that they ought not to consider any target in their countries or any form of weapon to be beyond the range of possibility. The Middle East, for better or for worse, is approaching the atomic age. Dimona has been in business for over 10 years. The Indian government is not the only government in that part of the world which has the capacity to develop atomic warheads. And we may not like to consider atomic deterrence as a contribution to peace. But the atomic deterrence has worked for the two superpowers for over 20 years. And if Israel can buy 20 years, the oil weapon ceases to have the power it now has. Many, many things will change. For time, my friends, is not simply working on the Arab side. When there is this kind of cataclysmic change in the balance of power in the world, it is rarely the first or second nation which enjoys the fruits of the wealth of the new world, the new discovery, which lives on to enjoy it. Spain and Portugal were the first to find the gold of the New World. But ultimately, it was France and Great Britain and Holland which prospered the most from the new trade, the new discovery. How long will it be before the nations of the West say, Dayenu, we're not going to take any longer the oil weapon, we're not going to allow our economies to be threatened by the kind of financial dislocation with which you are threatening us, action will be taken. Both the President and Mr. Kissinger spoke in those terms just 3 weeks ago. And though they may have spoken prematurely, and though the men of good intentions in the world raised their voices in moralistic horror at what they said. It was said. And it's being said very often and very privately in the corridors of power throughout the world. And if it is, it may not be the West that moves against the Arab world. It is rarely what you expect in the world that actually happens. I keep wondering to myself how long Black Africa will watch a few tens of thousands of Libyans burying their gold in Switzerland while they starve because they don't have the money to purchase the energy to begin the development of their nations. I wonder how long it will be that Afghanistan and Pakistan stand silently by while Iran ingests the great wealth flowing into it. Five countries of the world, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, Abu Dhabi and Libya, with a combined population of 11 million people, will receive this year $40 billion in oil revenue. How long will the 3 billion people of the world allow these 11 million that kind of economic power? How long will it be until the Arab world itself split asunder under the new wealth? Imagine two countries who live side by side, Abu Dhabi and Yemen. In Abu Dhabi this year, the per capita income is $47,000. Abu Dhabi is receiving $47,000 for every man, woman, and child Abu Dhabian. In Yemen next door,
The per capita income is $30 per year. How long will the Yemenites be quiet neighbors to the Abu Dhabians? How long will the poor Arabs working in the oil fields for wages in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, Bahrain, and these places serve their masters, living in huts, serving men who live in palaces? How long will it be? There's an incompleted revolution in the Middle East. It's got to take place, and this infusion of oil money will only speed up the process. And it may work again another way, more positive, less bloody way. I noticed in the press this week a little article saying that the Arab League had appealed to Kuwait not to grant citizenship to the Palestinians who have been working in Kuwait. The Arab League is eager that all Palestinians be listed as refugees, as political ploys. But what's Kuwait interested in? Kuwait is interested in the fact that these Palestinians whom they've employed not become a fifth column, that they integrate them as quickly as they can into the social order so that they all benefit in an equal sense from the new wealth. Now, in the short and middle term, all of this new money is going to mean new industry, new agriculture, road projects, development projects of all kinds. Who's going to work on these projects? We have mines in the West, engineers and scientists who can be bought, but who's going to do the hard work? The poor Arab. He's going to be attracted to employment. He's going to be attracted to higher wages. If there were any time in which a solution to the problem of the displaced Arab was economically possible, it's now. There are jobs. There is opportunity for anybody. The camps could be cleared overnight and put to gainful employment. And if they're not cleared by political action, they're going to be cleared by the people themselves. If they can get out from under the thumb of those who terrorize them, they're going to find work. Many already have. I don't know what the long-term actions or events are going to actually be. I'm not a prophet. But I do know that the Middle East will not be a year from now what it is today, and 5 years from now will have a totally different look than it has today. I do know that Israel will not always face the same set of political circumstances she faces now. And where there's change, there's possibility. I look upon the proposals being made now as disadvantageous to Israel because they are impossible of being worked out, and because they make it seem to the world as if it's only Israel's obstinacy, Israel's unwillingness to pull back, which is standing in the way to peace. What stands in the way to peace is what has stood in the way to peace for the last three decades. The simple statement by the Arabs, yes, Israel is. Those three words said by Sadat, said by Assad, said by Hussein, could solve the problems of Arab-Israel tensions in the Middle East in a fortnight. But they have not been said, and in my estimation, they will not be said in the near future. Remember the Scroll of Esther? When our people were in danger by the machination of Haman? And Mordecai, you'll recall, discovers the plot, and he goes to Esther, the beauteous queen, the favorite of the king in the palace, and he asks her to make a plea on behalf of her people, of the king, for their succor and deliverance. And in that, he makes the plea in these words. You hold your peace, he says, and deliverance and relief will arise for the Jews from another place. If you hold your peace, and relief and deliverance will arise from the Jews from another place, and deliverance will come. You will act, he said to Esther, it may come now. If not, it will surely come. And I'll give you this biblical text as a motto for us in the near future. What we need is patience, and what we need is faith. They're not going to be easy times for Israel. They're not going to be easy times for our world. But there is no reason to despair. Deliverance will come. And if the apostle of deliverance is not a Mr. Kissinger, and I do not believe he will be the apostle of peace, it will come in another place, in another way. But it will come.